Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This afternoon at NASA headquarters in Washington, President Bush outlined a new initiative to return American astronauts to the moon as early as 2015 and to use a permanent station there as a launching point for missions to Mars and beyond.
It is time for America to take the next steps. Today, I announce a new plan to explore space and extend a human presence across our solar system.
The president proposed $1 billion in new spending over the next 5 years and said he would shift an additional $11 billion from other NASA programs to support the new program. Under Bush's plan, the space shuttle fleet would be retired in 2010 after the completion of the International Space Station. The manned push onto Mars would, it is widely believed, cost hundreds of billions more and take decades. George Bush's Reach for the Stars vision comes at a time when there are many serious problems on planet Earth. And the president is running for re-election tonight on Point, the Moon, Mars, and Money, America's new space initiative. We blast off into tonight's conversation in the nation's capital with a look through the political telescope. Tamara Lipper is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I asked her how the big new vision is being received in Washington.
I think like most things in Washington, it depends which side of the aisle you're standing on. Many Democrats have been very critical of the president's proposal, saying that it's an election year kind of gambit to inspire reminders or comparisons to John F. Kennedy, and saying that the money that the president is devoting to this policy could be better spent on improving education or healthcare here on planet Earth. But others think that it's a noble goal, that it's continuing on in some of the greatest American sort of spirit of exploration. The president himself mentioned Lewis and Clark as an example of the manifest destiny, if you will, of the American spirit moving not just across the continental United States, but into outer space. And, you know, other people think that it's a very worthwhile scientific effort, that people have been very excited about the current rover mission on Mars and the possibility of finding water and perhaps evidence of some life on Mars, that those are all very important scientific goals to be reached.
What about the cost of this vision? The president talked today about just an additional $1 billion, but we read numbers as high as $500 billion attached to this.
Well, the White House has been very defensive on this issue of cost. They're very aware of both the criticism from their conservative base on the right, who don't like the idea of big government spending programs, and then also, as I mentioned, criticism from the left that the money should be better used in other areas. And so the White House has been very careful to only sort of project the near-term costs. As you mentioned, about $1 billion in the first 5 years. And the president today made extra effort to say that much of the cost of this initial plan that he laid out will be coming from reallocating existing NASA funds. So actually the money has already been budgeted, was his point, for much of this new focus, and he was trying to suggest that it wouldn't cost that much money. However, you know, it's unclear when you're talking about an initiative that might have a 10, 20, 30, perhaps 50-year lifespan. There's no way to know how much that will cost, and if we are in fact successful at making steps towards perhaps travel to Mars, there's no question that it'll cost a lot more money than the president outlined today.
There may be a political payoff in stirring rhetoric, but there's also jobs to be had here on the ground. What states might the president benefit in politically if the aerospace industry and NASA are boosted by this new plan?
Well, the White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan was asked specifically today whether this was a jobs program, and he sort of dodged the question, not going into the very specific key political states where the space industry has its home. He did mention Texas, the president's home state, as the only particular state he mentioned where Johnson Space Center and the space shuttle flights are mostly based down there. But obviously important states for the president's reelection, Florida being a big one, also California. There's no question that people living in those key electoral areas will be excited by the increased scientific research and even infrastructure money that will have to come into those states to man such an effort as this.
And tomorrow, what about the military aspect of this? Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas today, he's chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Science, Technology, and Space, said you always want the strategic high ground. There's talk that this is part of a new space race, despite the president's talk of, you know, all holding hands today, a kind of space race on the military front with China. Is that a piece of what's going on here?
Well, I think for conservatives particularly, it is a very appealing aspect of this. We're told, for instance, that Vice President Dick Cheney was making the military benefit argument to the president, for instance, and I think that has particular resonance with certain groups in political life here. But President Bush was remarkably silent on that aspect of the program. In fact, he rather emphasized the opposite, saying rather than a race, as the initial Apollo mission was, a race with the Soviets to the moon back in the 60s, he said that this isn't a race. He said it's a journey, and he invited international cooperation for his new mission to the moon and Mars. And so I think there's obviously added military benefit to some of the science and research and the technology, particularly if the idea of putting weapons up in space, for instance. But it's not something that the White House is using as its main selling point overall for this program.
Finally, tomorrow, what about next steps here? Does the president need sign-off from anyone, from Congress? Or if most of this is reallocation of existing NASA budget, can he just say, go and do this, and it's underway?
Well, he certainly needs sign-off from Congress for the new money that he's requesting, and he made that very clear today that he was going to ask Congress for an increase in NASA's budget, albeit in their view a relatively small one compared to the overall cost of the program. As for redirecting NASA, that is something that largely has been done or underway since last year when the Columbia blew up re-entering in its final mission last February. There was a need that everyone acknowledged that the space program had to be re-examined both for safety and whether it was actually worthwhile to risk the lives of American astronauts on these missions. So that was going to happen one way or the other, and I think that those efforts within NASA have started to take hold. And from what I gather from the reception the president got today, making a speech at NASA headquarters here in Washington, they seemed very excited by the new focus, the renewed energy. I think it was very uplifting for a lot of people working on a program that's become somewhat of a punching bag for folks here in Washington who haven't of late seen some of the great excitement that early space flight had for this country.
So a new far horizon, but much yet to be decided on the ground tomorrow. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tamara Lipper is White House correspondent for Newsweek. She spoke with me from Washington. We're talking tonight about the vision and science, the price and politics of a march on Mars. Are you ready to go back to the moon, to Mars, to infinity and beyond? Is this the right priority for America now? Is it our responsibility to explore space in the service of mankind's future? Or is it a costly distraction from life on Earth? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later on in the program, we'll hear from Sally Ride, the first American woman in space. But joining me right now from Washington is Howard McCurdy, professor of public administration at American University and author of several books about space, including Space in the American Imagination. Good evening and welcome, Howard McCurdy.
Good evening.
Great to have you with us. Also with me in the studio tonight is Kelly Beatty, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. He's been covering the space program for 30 years. It's great to have you, Kelly Beatty.
My pleasure, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. We want to get the first reaction from both of you to this big announcement. I mean, there was a long windup. Everybody knew it was coming. Kelly Beatty, this is where you guys keep your telescopes pointed. What's your response? We all want to be thrilled and are at some level thrilled by the idea of space exploration. On the other hand, it's so big, so long-term. Such a kind of commitment. We want to know it's the right thing. What's your response?
Yeah, I think NASA really needs some new direction because those who've been watching it for a long time know that it's been literally going around in circles with its International Space Station without a long-term goal that would really keep the fire of interest burning under its human exploration program. Science is a different question because we're doing lots of great things in science. I think this announcement is an almost inevitable outcome of the loss of Columbia because a lot of people were calling for change within NASA. This is a step that the president almost had to take. Whether or not it actually pans out is kind of not the issue here. It's something he needed to do.
But presumably there are many kinds of change that could be prescribed here. Do we really need a $500 billion moon to Mars mission? Is that the answer?
You have to understand the makeup of NASA. It has these field centers scattered across the country, and some of them are charged with building big things, like the Marshall Space Flight Center. Mm-hmm. The Kennedy Space Center is charged largely with launching big things into space. And you need big projects to keep those going. So in a sense, NASA has to, in order to sustain itself, it needs projects of this magnitude in order to keep going and not shrivel into a much smaller agency.
Howard McCurdy, how do you see this? You've looked a lot at how presidents interact with space and the poetry and imagery and business and politics of space. I mean, keeping NASA occupied is one thing, but at the potential cost of this, this seems like a bigger deal than just watching out to keep NASA occupied.
Well, it is a big deal here in Washington, D.C. People in the space community and the space agency have been calling for a focus for 30 years, ever since 1970 when Richard Nixon rejected the report of the Space Task Group plan, which would have carried out much of this. That was the plan. And now they've got it, and I think they'll celebrate tonight, and they'll sober up tomorrow morning and realize what they really have gotten themselves into, because the $500 billion program you're referring to is actually the Elder Bush's proposal, which was called the Space Exploration Initiative.
1989 also had a Mars mission in the middle of it.
And it had a Mars mission in it. And the first time they added it up, it was at $400 billion. And it probably would have gone over $1 trillion by looking at the kinds of infrastructure that was being developed. It was sort of the lures of space flight. Everybody in NASA was going to get well with this program.
Are you suggesting this one's different? This one's cheaper
If it's going to happen, it's going to be very different. It's going to be much like the robotic program. The rovers that landed on Mars that whole mission cost $830 million. The last time we put two landers on the surface of Mars in today's dollars cost $4 billion. So the robotics program is already running at rates that are 20% of what they used to spend. And this mandate and the way it's structured requires NASA to make similar, not as extreme, but similar gains in the human spaceflight program.
But what's up there now is the size of a golf cart. If we put a manned vehicle up there a settlement of some kind on Mars or a launch pad on the moon, and headed onto Mars, doesn't that get into very much larger figures? Can you really do that like a robotics program?
The goal is to do it on not exactly the same scale, but for a third to a half the cost of Project Apollo. In other words, not to spend more to do more, but to spend less to do more. And that's the challenge. I don't know that NASA is up for it at this stage. They're used to feeding their field centers, and that's the history of the Space Exploration Initiative was that the money was essentially spent on Earth and not spent any time in space. For space projects, it just didn't go anywhere. That's the history of the International Space Station. So this is a severe challenge for NASA to reform itself and do in the human spaceflight program what it's already done in the robotics program.
Kelly Beatty, can you see this being done on the cheap, or at least at a fraction of what projects have been done for before? What we expect from federal programs is something quite different, that the first numbers you hear end up being a small fraction of what things ultimately cost. And the last time it was toted up, as Howard McCurdy said, it came out to a much bigger number. Different this time or not?
It's a very interesting contrast. If you look at the pictures coming out of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory of the cheering controllers, they're all young people. You know, this JPL has managed to attract a very young breed, a new generation. The rest of NASA, by contrast, is getting very old and long of tooth. Bush made the point today that within 4 years, or maybe it was Sean O'Keefe, the administrator, mm-hmm. that within 4 years, a quarter of NASA's workforce will be eligible for retirement. In order for this to happen, with the retirement of the space shuttle in 2010, has to come the retirement of a lot of its existing engineers and an infusion of new talent to develop this technology. And I'm hoping he's successful. And it may be that one of the reasons for having a real visionary goal like this is to stir those engineers to come work for the space agency.
And can they do this project at a cost that doesn't blow another huge hole in the national budget?
They'll have to do it very differently than they approach the space station. I would be a little pessimistic because NASA does not have a good track record in this regard.
Kelly Beatty with Sky and Telescope Howard McMurdy in Washington, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the moon, Mars, and money, about the new American space initiative, at least as unveiled by George Bush today. Are you ready to go back to the moon, to Mars, to infinity and beyond? Is this the right priority, the right initiative for America now? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the moon, Mars, and money. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think of President Bush's big new vision for American exploration, manned exploration, and womaned, of space, outlined today at NASA headquarters in Washington? Is it our responsibility to explore space in the service of mankind's future, or is this a much more down-to-earth grab for contracts and votes? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The president waxed pretty rhetorical for a while today, talking about the American tradition of exploration.
Meriwether Lewis and William Clark left St. Louis to explore the new lands acquired in the Louisiana Purchase. They made that journey in the spirit of discovery, to learn the potential of the vast new territory, and to chart the way for others to follow. America has ventured forth into space for the same reasons. We have undertaken space travel because the desire to explore and understand is part of our character.
President Bush today outlining his vision for big new efforts that would send astronauts to the moon and astronauts to around Mars. We're joined tonight by Howard McCurdy from the American University in Washington, D.C. He's author of Space and the American Imagination. With me in the studio, Kelly Beatty, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. And joining us right now is Greg Easterbrook. He's senior editor at the New Republic magazine. He's been writing about the new space initiative proposals on his Easter blog, internet blog. Good evening and welcome, Greg Easterbrook.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Greg. Greg, you've been pretty tough in your blog on the whole idea. You said, for the moment, talk of a Mars mission is complete bunkum, that President Bush is either a science illiterate or this is a blank check for aerospace contractors. What's your gripe?
Oh, I'm sure that people will go to Mars someday. People may live on Mars someday. But to confuse that with saying that it's practical or sensible or makes budgetary sense today is bunkum. I'm glad you played the Lewis and Clark clip from the president's statement today. If you think about what happened when Lewis and Clark left, yes, they went on a mission of exploration, but they knew that they could live in the places they were going, and they were absolutely certain that they would find things of value. And finally, the cost of the Lewis and Clark expedition was far less than 1/100,000th of 1% of the national budget at that time. To go to Mars, we can't live there with current technology. There's only a tiny chance we will find anything of immediate value to the citizens of the United States, and the cost would be a meaningful percentage of the U.S. federal budget. The parallels are completely different.
Well, they might be, but you've just joined us. We've been hearing tonight from Howard McCurdy that perhaps this could be done at a fraction. And Howard, I hope I have you right here, at a fraction of the cost of Apollo, that the robotics trips and declining costs of exploration of Mars are the model here, that they're going to have to find all new ways. And, of course, you heard the numbers today, the president talking about $1 billion, $11 billion. Where do you think this is going to end up, Greg Easterbrook?
Oh, the president's numbers are laughable, and I don't blame him. Obviously, you don't expect him to understand these budget numbers, but his advisors should understand them. He said that $11 billion over the next 5 years would be enough to develop the crew exploration vehicle, the new spaceship that he projects, capable of going not just to the space station, but to the moon. Boeing is projecting that it will spend $7.5 billion just to develop the new 787 airliner, which stays in the air and uses very well-established engineering technology. Mm. The challenges of going to Mars, even if you take the most optimistic estimates that come from the Mars Institute that says that we can do this with a spacecraft that would only weigh a couple of hundred tons, which I find extremely unlikely. But even if you take their estimates, these estimates require the construction of a new super heavy lifter rocket far more powerful than the Saturn V, and the Saturn V itself costs $30 billion to develop in current dollars.
So do you see this back on the scale of George H.W. Bush's plan's price tag of $400 billion, $500 billion more? And if it is on that scale, that's such a large number, it's hard to take on board what it means for the U.S. federal budget.
Well, NASA in 1989, at George H.W. Bush's request, estimated that the total program cost, which is the number that matters, of a Mars mission would be $400 billion. In current dollars, that's $600 billion. You might be able to find some cuts somewhere. People talk about manufacturing fuel on Mars. That might turn out to be technically possible. But we've also learned since that estimate was made that the radiation challenge in transit from Earth to Mars is much more difficult than was previously estimated. And this will require tons of shielding that were not included in the $400 billion estimate. So if you could actually land a sophisticated and safe party on Mars and bring it back for $600 billion program cost, I think that makes sense to me. And maybe someday these things will happen, but to jump right ahead to these crazy cost no object goals rather than going one step at a time with the development of a more efficient and safe way to get pounds into low Earth orbit, which is the driving factor in all these calculations, seems to me science illiteracy.
But you say it'll happen someday. 2030 is what they're talking about for Mars. Is that someday or is that near term with a project like this?
Well, 30 years from now is a possibility, yes. If we spent 10 years doing nothing but developing cost-effective ways of putting pounds into low Earth orbit, which is the driving factor, as I said, in all these calculations, mm-hmm. then 10 years from now we could think about what makes sense based on whatever the pound per the cost per pound to low Earth orbit is 10 years from now. And that all that might result in people walking on Mars in 2030. It might result in people walking on Mars sooner than that. But you can't put the cart before the horse. Mm. When we don't know how to get pounds into orbit cheaply, to talk about 1,000 tons going to Mars, which was the 1989 NASA estimate, is nonsense.
Howard McCurdy, jump in here with us from Washington. Here's the half a trillion, $600 billion figure again. You're suggesting there may be another way. Are you painting a picture different from what we're hearing from Greg Easterbrook?
Let me explain the approach that Sean O'Keefe wants to take toward this. And I have to say, we don't know whether or not it's possible. The challenging initiatives like this seem impossible when you start, and sometimes they do turn out to be impossible. The space station is kind of the equivalent of Boston's Big Dig. If they go down that pathway, it'll probably kill the program. But here's a big difference. The Apollo program was a crash program. They had to get there by 1970. That drove the costs up considerably. Mm-hmm. Sean O'Keefe is stressing that this is a milestone program. They're going to take it a step at a time, developing the vehicle first and then moving on from that stage. And when he was pressed today in the press conference to say, well, when is this ultimately going to happen? He says, I don't want to put a date on it. What I want to do is establish milestones, and we'll take as long as we need to take to accomplish those particular objectives. So it may be possible, but we just don't know.
And pounds into orbit, this fundamental calculation, is there a way to change that? And how does the moon come into this? The moon's being described here as a way station of some kind on the way to Mars. Kelly Beatty, what function might it play?
When you want to go to Mars, you need to bring supplies along. You need water, you need air, you need the shielding for the radiation. And if you have to launch all of that from Earth, it's very expensive. Shuttle missions, which launch payloads up to 40, 50,000 pounds, cost the better part of $1 billion. That's a lot of money to get that stuff into orbit. If you can bring that cost down from Earth, you're halfway there. If you can get some of that material from the moon, where the gravity is lower and therefore the cost to launch it is lower.
The material from the moon being what?
Anything you can imagine.
You mean mined out of the planet, the moon itself?
Well, for example, radiation shielding, you can use dirt. Okay, and that would be a very plentiful supply of that. A lot of the moon has metals in it that you could use in an ideal way to construct pieces of your spacecraft. There is helium-3 in the soil, or in a wild imagination, there might be some water at the poles, which you could convert into fuel for your rockets. All of these things are possible, which is one of the reasons that the moon is the sort of first-order target for this new suite of launch vehicles.
Greg Easterbrook, the moon as the launch pad, what do you think?
Oh, based on what's known now, this is complete nonsense. Now, it is certainly possible that in the future we will acquire knowledge that makes this sensible. But all the Mars Direct estimates from 1993, which are the ones that the optimists use, not only didn't stop at the moon, but were based on the idea that stopping at the moon was nonsense, that everything had to be launched directly from low Earth orbit. Today, if we tried to mine oxygen, or maybe there's water on the moon, you know, ice water that could be turned into liquid water, this would require transporting all the manufacturing equipment from the Earth. So the gravitational benefit of taking materials off the moon would be nullified 20 times over by the cost of moving the manufacturing equipment from the Earth to the moon and then having to reboost everything out of the moon's gravity. The key figure, this will sound like a boring engineering figure to you, but when the lunar excursion module, the one thing that's landed on the moon and come back from the moon in all of space exploration history, the Apollo system, went there, the fuel fraction was two-thirds. Two-thirds of the weight of the LEM in orbit was fuel to land it on the moon and bring it back up into orbit. All the technology we have today would operate in essentially the same way. Stopping at the moon would be wasting two-thirds of the pounds of whatever was bound for Mars. Yes, a future technological breakthrough may alter that, but based on what we know today, stopping at the moon is just a way to drive the cost up for the benefit of aerospace contractors, not for the benefit of exploration of space.
Kelly Beatty, you're looking a little skeptical. Is there another path here?
Well, this issue of getting the resources from the moon. In 1989, we didn't realize that there might be a significant cache of ice at the poles of the moon. And if we can tap into that, it doesn't require a lot of technology to break that water down into hydrogen and oxygen or to purify it so you can haul it along with you to Mars for drinking water. So there is some potential gain by going to the moon for that reason alone.
Let's turn to San Diego for a second, where Sally Ride is joining us. She's a former NASA astronaut. In 1983, she became the first American woman in space. She's president and CEO of Imaginary Lines Incorporated, which supports girls' interest in space. Good evening and welcome, Sally Ride.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. Sally, your response to the president's announcement today. What do you make of the big vision?
Well, I'm excited about it because NASA has been without a vision like this for quite some time now. And it really needs it in order to be able to build the building blocks that we need to go on an exploration.
And how important is having astronauts along for this ride? Sally, you've been up there. You know it can be done with robots, and it's been done with humans. We know there's a debate over that that's gone on for years in the scientific community. Is this just dressing to build popular support, or is it a significant factor, an important factor?
I think it's an important factor. You know, for the last decade or so, we've actually had a pretty good mix of robotic exploration and human exploration. We've done an enormous number of really amazing things with robotic spacecraft, and the Spirit on Mars is one great example of that. We're looking for great things from it. And robotic missions to Mars will be necessary precursors to sending people there. There's a lot we need to learn about the planet before we even know how to go about sending people to Mars. But I think there's something that's just inherently exciting about sending people. I mean, people explore. It's what we do. It's what we've done for thousands and thousands of years. And it's something that we will be doing in the future, and it's just a matter of whether we start the next phase of that exploration now or whether we wait.
Sally Ride, what are the scientific challenges of having human beings on board a vehicle that goes to Mars? It must add any number of extra challenges that aren't there with a robot. Can you lay some of them out for us?
It does add extra challenges, but perhaps the biggest one is just logistics. I mean, you basically have to find a way to feed and clothe people and keep them alive and keep them healthy for the length of a trip to Mars. And with the technology that we've got today with propulsion, it actually takes many months to get to Mars, so it's not a small undertaking.
And what have we learned from these long deployments on the space station on the human body in the weightless condition? Can it, or do we know yet, can it stand the duration of a trip to Mars?
It definitely can. People have been on board the space station for up to a year. There's been a couple of Russian cosmonauts who spent a year in weightlessness in space. So we know the human body can withstand a year. The problem is that, in weightlessness, your bones start to lose calcium. You start to lose bone mass. And so the bones slowly get weaker and weaker, and you don't want that to be occurring over a year period if you've got to then use your bones once you get to Mars and then withstand the trip back. So there are actually several factors that we need to understand better, including how to keep people's muscles active and not atrophy in weightlessness, and how to keep bone mass up so that once you get to Mars, you can actually do useful things, be healthy, and do all the exploration that that you're being paid to do.
Sally Ride, stand by for a second. A lot of callers want to join us. Dennis is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Very enjoyable program.
Great.
Shouldn't we be looking at this as an investment in basic science? I mean, you know, somewhere along the way, we do have to advance our technology and just our understanding of basic science in total. And, yes, it's nice to have Mars and the moon, but I'm more excited just about the fact that the government is helping to fund the basic science research, just like the National Health Institute does in the other science.
So you're feeling confident that there would be spinoffs out of this research that would benefit life on Earth, Dennis?
Oh, definitely. I mean, just look at the advancements from the Moon Project, whether it's in ceramics that dentists use, whether it's in computers, whether whatever, it doesn't matter.
Greg Easterbrook, how about that? Let me put it to you. And Dennis, thank you for your call. Is this a laboratory that's the only way we're going to make some of these scientific breakthroughs, the pressure, the resources that go into a big vision, a long-term vision like this?
Oh, I don't have any doubt that investments like this will create scientific spin-off benefits, but any way you spend hundreds of billions of dollars will create spin-off benefits. The Apollo program in current dollars cost roughly $100 billion, and the spin-offs from it are a few breakthroughs in material science, Tang, a few advantages in computational science. Investing $100 billion in basic R&D would have produced far more than that. And if you look at the budget of the National Institutes of Health versus the amounts of money that are projected for program cost of a Mars mission, you could accomplish far more with Earthbound research, even though, yes, of course, ultimately, in the course of devising Mars mission technology, we're bound to discover something useful, yes.
Greg Easterbrook, we're hearing skepticism on many fronts from you tonight. What do you think is the motivation behind this plan if you're not buying the timetable, the budget, the scientific payoff?
Well, Mars is a romantic destination. I look up at Mars at night in the sky, and when I'm out in the woods, you can almost see the red sheen. It would be fascinating to be there. I'd love to be there. Mars is an Earth-like planet. It's much more Earth-like than Venus is. It doesn't have the runaway greenhouse effect that Earth does, that Venus does. There may have been a point in the past where there was some kind of microbial life there. I'd give anything to know the answers to the questions of Mars's history and origin. But Mars will always be there. We don't have to go there immediately on a cost-no-object basis. It makes much more sense to explore it with robotic probes and try to crack this nut of placing pounds into low-Earth orbit. If we had a sensible, cost-effective way to do that, then all the grand missions of space would become possible.
And Sally Ride, what about yourself? Would you put a son or daughter of your own on a mission to Mars? And is this the time to begin pushing to do it?
I absolutely would. In fact, I'd go myself if they'd let me. I think that this is the time to do it. It's at least time to put forth the vision and to give us a conceptual framework for developing the exploration program. Because without that conceptual framework, you don't know what launch vehicles to build. You don't know what vehicles to build to replace the space shuttle. You really don't have a vision that kind of puts meaning into all the infrastructure that you're building.
And Sally, last question, this next footprint on Mars, if that's what it is, likely to be a woman's?
Hey, you know, it might be. I wouldn't be at all surprised if there aren't both men and women on the crew to Mars.
Sally Ride, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sally Ride, former NASA astronaut, 1983, she became the first American woman in space. And Greg Easterbrook, I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. Greg Easterbrook, senior editor at the New Republic magazine. We're talking about the moon, Mars, and money tonight. Howard McCurdy is with us, Kelly Beatty. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the moon, Mars, and money, about the new American Space Initiative. My guest tonight from Washington, Howard McCurdy, professor of public policy at American University and author of Space and the American Imagination. With me in the studio, Kelly Beatty, executive editor, Sky and Telescope magazine, and so many questions on the table tonight. Can the deficit-ridden USA afford a zillion-dollar initiative in space? Can we afford not to go? Do you believe the human future is in space? Or not? And is space the right target, the inevitable target for our biggest dreams? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Let me just say, first off, I'm all for space exploration.
Okay.
And NASA gave us, you know, fuel cell technology and desktop computers, you know. But, you know, on the other hand, I mean, I find it particularly ironic that this administration that is proposing this is the same one that withdrew us from the Kyoto Protocol, and the reason for doing so was it would be too much of a cost to our economy, mm-hmm. and you know, and yet they want to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on a mission to Mars, and yet you know they don't want to do anything about the climate, and. I believe in space exploration. I think it is the long-term future of humanity. But you know, but the people living in this century will be much more affected by climate change. And I think, from the point of view of developing countries that will be impacted by climate change the most, I mean, spending you know all this money on space exploration is more than ironic. It's obscene. I mean, that's what it comes right down to.
Tom, I don't know who couldn't feel a little bit of that in the back of their mind, or maybe a lot, and thanks for voicing it just that way. Howard McCurdy, how about it? I mean, what is, on the one hand, President Bush is right. We are an exploring species. We're proud of all the stories from the past and no doubt want to make new ones in the future. On the other hand, caller Tom says, what about our planet right here at home? I'm even reading in the last few weeks this kind of drumbeat of opinion that's looking out into space as humankind's emergency backup home. Like if we just screw it up completely here, well, we'll move there. Where do you come down?
Yeah, that is a very interesting point. It goes back to some of the people who believe we should protect ourselves from asteroids striking the Earth by going off to Mars. Well, if you look at Mars, you can see there are a lot of craters on Mars, so it's not immune.
Something's landed there.
But
how do you balance these issues? You know, quality of life on Earth, quality of exploration in space.
Oh, I can't tell you how everybody should balance them. I can tell you the approach that the White House and NASA is using. And the approach they're using is that NASA has about a $15 to $16 billion budget. This proposal stays pretty much within that budgetary ceiling. It's not like Project Apollo, which saw a fivefold increase in NASA's budget in the first 5 years of that project. Basically, what the White House has said to NASA is, if you really want to go back to the moon and on to Mars, do it with the money you've got that's not going to get spent on housing or environmental protection. It's going to get spent on space, but focus your programs on this particular objective and don't do some of the other things that you might otherwise do.
So you don't think it's an either-or situation? With this lower price that you're willing to believe it can be done at, you don't see this as detracting from projects on Earth?
I don't see the money being spent on housing, for example, if it's not spent on space. It'll be spent on space. The question is it going to be spent on things like the space shuttle flying for another 30 years, or is it going to be spent on more of a destination-focused space program? That's the issue as it was debated here in Washington, D.C. So the money is kind of a given at this stage. There's not a major increase in the NASA budget that at least initially is required to fund this. And I think in the long run, if somebody stands up and says we've got to double the NASA budget to do this, that the proposal is dead on arrival. It's interesting that...
Well, I wonder if they can really do that. I mean, once all the staffs and factories get cranked up around the country and aerospace companies and many employees and states' economies become dependent on this, is it that easy to pull the plug?
Well, that's the danger, and that's where the test is going to come. But we've already heard from the Congress. This was initially supposed to be a $2 billion increase in NASA's budget. The proposal isn't more than a week or two old and being vetted here in Washington, D.C., and it's already down to $1 billion increase. So it's certainly headed in the other direction.
Well, it may be right now. We'll see what happens long term. Tom, keep your sharp eye on it. Monica's calling from Boston. Hi, Monica. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a graduate student at MIT, and I've been involved in the past, like, 4 years dealing with space initiatives.
Yeah, great.
And your original question was, is it our responsibility to explore space?
To future generations, to begin to get out there. Mm-hmm.
Well, I do not believe it is a moral imperative. I do not believe it has a moral dimension. What I do see it as is inevitable, that life will find a way to expand and to seek out new venues, to seek out new niches. Mm-hmm. And my question is, which hasn't been addressed yet in this program, is the role of private industry. Because whether the government can hack it or not, whether NASA can hack it or not, I really don't know. But there are private billionaires, private people who have tons and tons of money who also have a dream, and they're more motivated to invest in space, to go for their dreams.
But, Monica, you studied this. Presumably, most billionaires wouldn't spend their entire fortune on a dream. Is there a profit motive in going to Mars that might be harvested any time in my lifetime or yours or our grandchildren's?
Not necessarily a profit motive.
Well, actually, isn't that what private industry ultimately requires to put in billions and billions of dollars?
Well, they have billions of dollars to spend, right?
Well, but usually they require a return on that.
Well, that's my question to you then. What future do you see
for private enterprise here? It's a great question. How about it, Kelly Beattie?
You know, she touched on a very interesting aspect of this. One thing I had hoped I would hear from the president but didn't was some alternative to the moon as an intermediate step. For example, there are a number of people, some of them commercially minded, who would like us to go to asteroids before we go to the moon. Now you say, well, why go to asteroids? Well, first of all, it's a more logical intermediate step to Mars in terms of trip length and technology.
Are there substantial enough asteroids in orbit closer to Earth that they make more sense than the moon?
Yes. There are lots of asteroids that cross Earth's orbit and make them actually less energetic to get to than the moon. But more importantly, some of them are made almost entirely of metal. And with that metal, not only iron, but you get a lot of other things that go along with iron, like platinum group metals. It's conceivable that you could build a mission, fund it commercially, venture capital, however you want, that could go to an asteroid, send Bruce Willis if you have to.
So if we wait for that to happen, will it happen in this time frame or 100 years from now or 500 years from now?
Oh, no. We're talking about something you could do shorter term that could be funded largely by industry, that could bring back enough chunk of metal hitched to the trunk that you could pay for it if
not. To build and go on. But the government's not talking about that, as you said.
And I found that really surprising.
Mordecai is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Mordecai. You're on the air.
Thank you. And Mr. Ashbrook, let a peon get about 60 seconds to speak here.
Well, that's about all we've got. So that's about all we've got, Mordecai. So please go.
Pardon?
That's about all we've got. So have at it.
Okay. Military aspects. This is nothing more than the CESA high ground control, the gravity well to the moon, prevent other countries' rocket ships from taking off. This is nothing more than another attempt to be able to impose genocide upon any target country. And let me interpret for the peoples of the world when they see this pathetic little, this smirking chimp announce this, they feel horror and terror. And this is just, I'm shaking with rage, and I realize the Homeland Security Gestapo is going to track down this call, but...
Mordecai, we've got your point. You see military plans for space and think that all the rest is hogwash. Howard McCurdy, there's not much bones made about it among any number of congressmen. They do see a big military side to this. How important, how significant is that?
The military has not been interested in putting people in space since about 1969 when it developed remote sensing for its reconnaissance satellites. There is some military interest in acquiring the ability to put soldiers in space to protect assets like the reconnaissance satellites.
But, of course, this will involve more than manned presence there. We've got Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas saying today, yes, you want to get that strategic high ground. We understand Dick Cheney's a big proponent of this. Do you see a military motive front and center or very marginal?
At this stage, it's marginal. Yes, it's always been part of the rationale for moving into space, the high ground initiative. But in terms of this particular initiative, the military at this stage is on the sidelines.
Kelly Beattie, do you agree?
I absolutely agree. If for no other reason, the UN prohibits, UN agreements prohibit the use of space for military purposes. And as Howard pointed out, the military...
Do you really think that would deter any number of people in Washington right now? I mean, the UN would be a reason they wouldn't do it.
I think the people who talk this high ground argument don't understand the concept. It sounds good on paper, but in reality, it doesn't get them much for their dollar.
Kelly Beattie, how are you betting tonight? We just have a few seconds left. Is this going to happen? Is it going to unfold 2030? Will we have astronauts circling Mars?
I would say no.
2040?
Maybe.
2050?
We need a better economic climate. That's the thing. You can't do it in a deficit budget situation like the president has gotten himself into.
Well, and that's going to be around for a long time. So stay tuned, folks. Space is out there. It will wait. How soon we get there is another question. Kelly Beattie, thank you so much for being with us
tonight. My pleasure.
Kelly Beattie, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, and Howard McCurdy in Washington, thank you for being with us.
It's always interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Onward and upward. Howard McCurdy, professor of public policy at American University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. A Palestinian suicide bomber, a 22-year-old mother of two, blew herself up today at a major checkpoint between Israel and the Gaza Strip. Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack, which killed four Israelis and wounded at least seven others. Israeli officials have accused terrorists of setting out not only to kill Israelis, but to cripple the Palestinian economy. The checkpoints are critical thoroughfares for thousands of Palestinian workers. Alan Myers is a Boston-based pediatrician traveling with a group of medical professionals in the West Bank who are working with the human rights group Physicians for Human Rights Israel. The group co-authored a report charging that the Israeli army had obstructed medical services to Palestinians in the West Bank. Myers spoke with On Point from Nablus in the West Bank about the security checkpoints and the problems they pose.
The number I've heard is that there are 757 checkpoints, according to a United Nations agency, in the occupied territories. These checkpoints are scattered around, obstructing traffic between villages, towns, and cities. These checkpoints are staffed by armed soldiers, and if you're a Palestinian, you must show identification and be allowed to pass. In general, if it's a large checkpoint, there would usually be jersey barriers in the road, oriented parallel to the road, and then some blockades across it. People may wait any length of time, from a short period of time to hours. It might be raining, it might be hot. People wait. Often, ambulances are not permitted to pass, even if they're carrying patients who are sick or wounded. This happens especially during times of conflict, for example, when the military mounts an incursion into a city, as they did in Nablus over the past 3 weeks. Up until the last couple of days, no ambulances were permitted out of the city. In fact, ambulances weren't permitted to travel around the city during that period of time. They set up roadblocks within the city, in fact. There have been a number of cases of women actually delivering at checkpoints because the ambulances were forbidden to pass. We had a minor incident today that we experienced ourselves. We were heading for a village outside of Nablus, which, because of a checkpoint, people can't easily get out of that village to get health care or anything else. So we had to pass two roadblocks on the way out, two checkpoints, rather. Now, these were smaller checkpoints. There was some dirt piled in the road, and there were army vehicles astride the road. They let us pass after they sort of kept us for a while and inspected us and looked at our documents, and I had to explain what I was doing here. They did let us pass. We arrived in this village. We had our clinic. We saw a lot of patients. We had 75 patients, most of them children and some elderly with chronic illnesses, children with acute illnesses. We loaded up all of our equipment. We got back in the ambulance. That's how they moved their medical personnel around. And we tried to drive back into Nablus. We were forbidden to pass the checkpoint that had let us out in the other direction just a few hours before. So we weren't able to get back into the city. We had to find a different way in, which we were fortunate enough to do. So people can't get around, and people can't get to health care, and sometimes health care can't get to people. I certainly can't get inside the mind of someone who would kill themselves. What I have seen, and we've heard really from everyone, people feel as if they are in prison in their own country. And people have been humiliated at the checkpoints. This is a symbol of, not just a symbol, but it's a real manifestation of their imprisonment.
Alan Myers is a Boston-based pediatrician working with the human rights group Physicians for Human Rights Israel in the West Bank. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.